Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. A little bit later this hour, we'll be talking about a survey from earlier this year of Angelenos about their attitudes about law enforcement and how their community interacts with the law. We'll talk with Fernando Guerra, professor of political science at Loyola Marymount University. He directs the Center for the Study of Los Angeles, which conducted this survey. Again, this is before George Floyd dying at the hands of law enforcement in Minnesota, but still gives a sense of sort of what were the conditions earlier in this year in various Los Angeles communities that come into play at this point in time. Joining us now from UC Irvine, Assistant Professor of Political Science and author of The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics, Davin Phoenix. Professor, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about the effects of anger and I guess sort of define some terms. When we talk about anger, we understand what that means on a personal, individual basis. How are you using the term here to describe anger among group members?
That's really important to unpack. When we consider anger at the individual level, we're considering a sense of indignation or outrage over a perceived slight. It's not just a frustration over something not going your way. It's something that you expected to work out for you, it didn't happen, and you feel slighted by that. So at the collective level, when we think about a group or a set of people, an electorate, a set of constituents feeling anger, we can consider how they feel slighted. They feel they have been wronged in some way. There's a sense of entitlement there inherent in that definition, in that understanding. And so we have to broaden our lens and consider what people expect from their government or from their system of politics and how it may or may not meet those expectations. So thinking about that role of collective anger, I find that type of collective anger much more effective at moving white Americans to political actions than it does for Black Americans. And I argue in the book, there's a couple of things at work there. One, African Americans don't have the same set of expectations or entitlements from the system. Argue there's a large swelling of resignation among African Americans, perceiving themselves as not likely to get the same responsiveness from any governmental regime as their white counterparts, rather than feel angered over things that they find dissatisfactory, right? They kind of let it roll off their back. In contrast, white Americans having a greater sense of entitlement or expectation of what they can expect from the system can be moved from those slights to anger. So thinking about what we're seeing with the current unrest, I think we're seeing a lot of exasperation and a lot of fatigue boiling over. As Black people say, we have been dealing with these particular slights for so long, and particularly in the epicenter, Minneapolis, people that I'm sure are the front lines in the response to George Floyd's death were likely on the front lines in response to Philando Castile's death in 2016 and thinking, you know, we might have had any kind of regime change, but we still have these same unaccountable policing practices that have been vexing us. And so I think that's really important to consider when we think about how anger operates for these groups, because we can label a lot of different things anger, right? But there is a difference between that sense of, you know, I'm mad as heck, I'm not gonna take it anymore, I expect more from the system, and a kind of anger that more is tied to exasperation, like I expect so little from the system and still what I get is so devastating, I have to act out in some way.
And just one of the way, you know, looking at sort of the externalization, one of the ways that I see the term being used is sometimes it's expressed as though this is righteous anger, but sometimes the term anger is used to diminish the sentiment, to portray something as an emotional injury as opposed to a deeper hurt. And so I think, you know, sometimes people use anger to suit their own worldview to sort of justify their conclusions about what is legitimate dissent or what isn't.
That's absolutely right. I think it's certainly a potentially loaded term, and we have to consider the kind of way in which that term of anger can be racialized, the way in which we have other words that are racialized in our public discourse, such as inner city, right? When we say inner city or urban, we're thinking about Black people, right? We can consider the ways in which anger connected to Black people or marginalized people broadly can be used as pejorative, as though people are acting without rationality and acting in a destructive way. And so in that way, that kind of discourse, thinking about Black people's anger, can very easily be tied to and reinforce long-running stereotypes connecting Black people to criminality. In contrast, we can think about the ways in which our narratives around white expressions of anger are not necessarily tied to those pejoratives to the same degree. And we can see a vivid contrast, right, in how armed protesters as part of the reopen protests were treated, not just in the media discourse, but maybe more importantly, the response, the much more muted response from police and authorities.
I have to say, though, I often hear in analysis of supporters of President Trump, it referred to as angry white people. And the implication is that they're mad at a changing America. They've latched onto President Trump because of racial standing. And certainly that's a legitimate opinion to hold, but it also is a sort of superficial analysis of multifaceted things that are at work in the appeal of President Trump. So I certainly hear your point about it. It's a way of sort of reducing the longstanding hurt of African Americans. But I think that the term has been used recently against white people as well.
Sure, I think we can consider the ways in which we can paint very broad, paint any kind of group or constituency with a very broad set of strokes. I think I would argue the difference is, even if there are pejorative framings of Trump supporters in some of the public discursive spaces we have about this block of people, we certainly don't see the same kind of state level response or the same police response to this group when they are taken to the streets in protests or when they are engaged in any kind of rallies or collective public space behavior. So I think even when we consider the differences or potential similarities in how groups can be targeted or labeled unfairly, perhaps, as angry, we still have to consider the very different responses of the agents of the state to these different sets of groups when they're expressing that anger in public spaces.
We're talking with Davin Phoenix, assistant professor of political science at UC Irvine. He's author of The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. We'll continue our conversation with him. I welcome your thoughts about what the professor is laying out, the thesis of his book. 866-893-5722, the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll talk more about the intersection of anger with politics in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. So good to have you with us, with UC Irvine Assistant Professor of Political Science, Davin Phoenix. His recently published book, The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. We've had a sort of debate back and forth among listeners over the past few days, Professor Phoenix, over whether the violence that erupts surrounding a peaceful protest is a change agent or not, and a positive change agent, or whether it does damage to the noble cause of protest. What's your thoughts about that and how anger manifests itself in a variety of behaviors?
Well, my thinking, informed by history and social science, I think may not be comforting to folks that find the images of violence unsettling or disquieting. But thinking about work of my peers, prominently Legina Gauss at UC San Diego, she finds looking at protests and demonstrations of marginalized groups that when they do indeed escalate to what we typically label in our media framing as violence, they are indeed likely to get substantive legislative responses. And so when we think about the historical context, we can see that some of the major milestone civil rights legislation of the mid-20th century was passed in the midst of outbreaks, not just of demonstrations and protests, but actual violence in urban cities. And so we have to consider the degree to which peaceful protests that we can all take comfort in might not necessarily move the needle and detail the weight of gravity and urgency of the situation. We can consider even how media frames have certainly gravitated towards images of property destruction, perhaps at the detriment of the many peaceful protests taking place in places in which, you know, officers and the protesters are kind of cooperating. And so we have to consider the roles, right, of all these different forces, particularly media, in continuing to promote the story. So it's not to say that there's opportunism or opportunity in kind of creating violence, but would we be thinking about these issues? Would we be thinking about the deep underlying racial wounds if these protests had kind of come and gone without the escalations of violence? And
I again, wonder.
I recognize these are difficult questions to ask, but we need to be asking these questions of ourselves.
No, and I wonder, though, if what really moved American values, so to speak, was riots that took place in various American cities in the mid-60s, or was it seeing police violence against peaceful protesters and those images that were the more powerful, more activating images? What do you think?
Well, I think we could certainly work to parse it out, but I think we also have to recognize that those types of images are always hand in hand with one another, and they continue to be hand in hand today. So just as we can be moved by images of property destruction or alleged looting incidents, we can be moved by the very visceral images that at least are fully kind of perpetuated on alternative media sources or social media sources without the traditional media gatekeepers of police escalating and acting in violence against peaceful protesters. And so I think that occasions us to ask about the ways in which we might be lumping different types of violence, different types of escalation together. And I think that can certainly muddle the message. But when we do see these images of police amplifying, escalating, and responding to people that are nonviolent and even journalists and people that are kind of bystanders with violence, that certainly has to move the needle. That certainly has to give a new weight of credibility to the people that are originally saying we have been unfairly targeted and brutalized by police forces for too long. And so, you know, do we differentiate those kinds of images? Are they lumped together in our mind? Are they lumped together in our collective memory? I think time will tell, but it's hard to think about one without the other because they certainly reinforce one another.
Yeah, I just think the emotional response, speaking of anger, is vastly different to them. Professor, I appreciate your being with us and sharing your research from your book, The Anger Gap, How Race Shapes Emotion in Politics. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Assistant Professor of Political Science at UC Irvine, Davin Phoenix, joining us on Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We just got word that the Los Angeles County curfew has been extended to this evening, 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., a curfew countywide in Los Angeles.